This is Points North Art Forms. Are we witnessing the death of a major American symphony orchestra, namely the Detroit Symphony? Musicians have been working without a contract for several months. Negotiations have sometimes been bitter and personal. Recently, the entire percussion section of the orchestra left and the remainder of the season canceled. Later in the show, we'll talk with music director of Interlaken, Kedrick Merwin, who will talk about the implications of the orchestra's troubles and how it might affect Interlaken in the future. Talking with us now from WDET in Detroit is a reporter who has been closely watching the union management struggle, Noah Ofshinsky. Noah, welcome.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Good to have you. How and when did the trouble start with the Detroit Symphony, Noah?
Oh, Brad, that is a long and complicated question, and it depends on how you gauge the trouble. Financially speaking, the DSO has been in trouble for years now. And since then, you know, they've dipped into, funds that they've had in the savings account, and they've been dipping into that to sort of backfill their budgets. Well, that strategy is simply they're running out of money. They only have, you know, several million dollars left in savings. And once that's gone, this is in their endowment fund. Once that's gone, it's gone. And the DSO will literally be without a penny. And so that led the management at the DSO to, negotiate a new contract with the musicians that they think will help improve their financial position.
Now, you said that there were warning signs years ago. Were those warning signs ignored?
I'm not sure they were ignored. The labor situation between the musicians and management has never been great, or at least it hasn't been great in recent years at the DSO. There's always been tension between management and musicians. But it really came to a head when management put forward a proposal to cut pay upwards of 30% for musicians. That was a proposal that was floated last year right before the musicians went on strike.
How unusual is that for a major orchestra?
Almost unheard of. If you talk to any expert in the industry, they'll tell you that a 30% pay cut at this level, you know, and we're talking about maybe the top 10 orchestras in the country, at that level, 30% is just completely unheard of. And of course, you know, salary is one part of this. And of course, changes to work rules that management wants to make is sort of the other part of this equation.
Our listeners can be a part of this edition of Points North was recorded earlier. Please, no phone calls at this time.
To ask Noah Ofshinsky a question, give us a picture of what management wants other than that pay cut. I understand that the musicians are pretty up in arms about a plan that management wants to be able to send musicians out into the community for education and outreach. What's wrong with that?
Well, if you ask the musicians, there's a lot wrong with that. The musicians will tell you that at their level, and as we said, you know, the top 10 orchestra level, they'll say that they really should only be paid to do two things. And that's traditional at orchestras at that level. They're paid to rehearse and they're paid to perform. And that's pretty much it. What management would like them to do, as you alluded to, is send them out into the community to perform in smaller groups, to tutor, and basically become marketing devices of the orchestra. And, you know, management around the country in that industry have wanted to do this, but musicians have really resisted it, I mean, tooth and nail in recent years. And if the DSO were to accept those kinds of changes, it would be the first time a major orchestra did embrace what it's actually in the industry, it's called service conversion, which is converting, you know, something like a performance and or a rehearsal and converting that into some other aspect of their job, like, you know, performing in smaller groups in the community.
Why wouldn't the musicians want to do that? After all, I could see this building future audiences.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think they would tell you that, you know, that such changes may be inevitable at some point industry-wide, but they'll tell you that Detroit is not the place to do it simply because while you're asking them to make these, changes, I shouldn't say severe, but just changes to their work rules, they're also asking them to take anywhere between a 20 and 30% pay cut and that you shouldn't be asking for both at the same time. You know, I think they're they're thinking that this is something that may happen eventually industry-wide, but they're not prepared to do it during these negotiations.
Has the union suggested to management, look, let's do one at a time, let's do this in steps, this would be better for the musicians, certainly more comfortable for the musicians, you know, sort of a stepped, you know, response to it instead of all at once?
Yeah, no, I mean, they've been pretty adamant against you know, being forced to do this community work or tying their salaries to this community work. I mean, across the board, they're pretty much against it, regardless of whether or not it happens in steps or not. Of course, management will argue that they can't afford to do these things in steps, that they're running out of money. And let me tell you, the financial situation is bleak for the DSO. And I think from management's perspective, they don't have time to waste. The changes that they feel they need to make to the labor contract are changes that they feel will save, at the end of the day, will save the orchestra.
Now, early this week, the musicians agreed to return to work temporarily, at least, under management's proposals. And their argument was this will at least help save the orchestra. We'll do our part. We'll cave a little bit. But the musicians said they would return to the bargaining table only under the rules of binding arbitration. Now, what was the management's reaction to that offer?
Well, of course, the devil is always in the details.
Right,
and
right.
Actually, we're still waiting, to be honest with you. Since that announcement, since that flurry of activity that was earlier this week, we've been waiting to find out what exactly that means. As of now, I don't believe they've made any sort of agreement. I know the lawyers for the both sides have met to figure out what is binding arbitration going to look like and what is a return to work going to look like. Assuming they even go into binding arbitration, what are the work rules and what are the salaries that the musicians are willing to work under while that process plays out? And at this point, we don't have an answer to that question. So it seemed like a breakthrough at the time, but we're still waiting to find out what it means.
Now, based on your observations, do you have a guess as to what binding arbitration would look like if that happened?
Yeah, I've talked to some, you know, law professors and practitioners of this sort of thing, and they say that, you know, basically the musicians have proposed this. They want a mediator from their side, a mediator from the orchestra, and a third mediator that will be picked by both sides to make up a three-person panel. And whatever changes that they want to make to the contract, whatever their decision will be based on a majority vote. So for two of three of those panel will have to agree on whatever they're dealing with. And from what we understand, the issues that panel will be dealing with are those that the musicians and the management say are sort of the last outstanding issues. I mean, they've made some headway on other issues, but as I said, you know, the service conversion issue, the community service issue, the salary issue, the size of the orchestra, there are still some issues that need to be worked out. And those are the issues that this three-person panel will grapple with.
Do you have a hunch as to which side binding arbitration would be favored by?
Yeah, that's tough. You know, it's interesting. I mean, one thing that I've learned from covering this for now 5 months is that, you know, the orchestra business, there is no other industry like it. It's really unique. And so I think it'll be a challenge, especially for whoever that third panelist is, you know, the person who's not going to be an advocate for either side.
Right.
It's going to be a challenge for that person, I think, to really understand and take into consideration the dynamics of what it is to be a musician in a top 10 orchestra or what it is to be a member of management at a top 10 orchestra, much less an orchestra that is dealing with dire finances. So I don't think, to be honest with you, I don't, but I don't envy the position that they're in because there's going to be quite a learning curve.
Now, I can see how some fans of the DSO might be saying, hey, look, in this economy, working for around $80,000 per year versus about $104,000 per year isn't that bad. I mean, there's a lot of people who would love to be making 80 grand a year. What are the musicians saying to the fans who are responding that way?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that a lot, and I've heard that a lot, you know, actually mainly from people who don't necessarily go to the DSO or listen to classical music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's people who, you know, work just sort of blue collar jobs, you know, who look at the news or listen to us and say, you know, what are they thinking? What are they doing striking at making $80,000, you know? But you know, the fact is the musicians say, and they've long argued, that if they accept these pay cuts in conjunction with the changes to the work rules, the overall quality of the orchestra is going to go down, and Detroit's going to lose its place amongst the top orchestras in the country. I mean, it's from the musician standpoint, you know, this is all tied into pay, and musicians do make decisions about where they go and where they choose to play of with, among other things, money in mind. I mean, like the rest, exactly, like the rest of us.
Sure.
And from their perspective, they think musicians, potential musicians who are going to come to the orchestra, aren't going to want to come to Detroit because A, they're going to be making less, and B, because they're going to be forced to work out in the community. So they see it really as a fight for the soul and the identity of the DSO as it's currently instituted.
So their opinion is, even if they went back to work and said, okay, we're going to cave in, we're going to work for $80,000 a year, we'll go out into the community, the union isn't very optimistic about that improving the orchestra, say, 5 to 10 seasons down the line, right?
Yeah, I mean, they have talked about a lot about the executives and what's happening in the front office, so to speak, at the DSO. They've long said, as you alluded to, that even if they were to agree to these changes, there's no guarantee that the DSO would be able to lift itself out of the quagmire that it's in. And they point to the fact that the DSO has had several development officers in the last few years. I mean, it's basically the position. It's been sort of a revolving door, frankly. There hasn't been a lot of stability in that very important office. I mean, a development office at a DSO, at any orchestra, much less an orchestra in a region that's suffering as much as we are economically, it's a critical position. And the musicians say that all that turnover in that office has led to even a worse financial situation than there normally would be. Of course, the relationship also between the musicians and the senior management is also quite toxic and has been for months now. And I don't think the musicians really have any faith or trust in, CEO Ann Parsons or any of the executive management.
What do you see as a solution, if you see a solution at all?
Well, I think at this point, one of two things are going to happen. I think if it indeed goes to binding arbitration, if the two sides agree to binding arbitration, it's going to get decided, Brad. I mean, one way or another, you know, somebody's going to go back to work under whatever rules that the arbitration panel comes up with. So if it does go to binding arbitration by its sheer nature, which is binding, that will at least resolve the temporary issue. The other thing that could happen is that, you know, the management could wait the musicians out even further and wait till, you know, they come back to the table without conditions. That's a possibility. I don't think the management is going to sort of give up on their key demands. I don't see that happening. It could, but I don't see it happening. I mean, 2 weeks ago, they walked away from the rest of the season. I mean, they canceled the rest of the season after the musicians voted down what management called their last offer. So I think this management has shown that they're willing to keep the stage lights dark for however long it takes in order to fix this issue. The other thing, the caveat to this is binding arbitration is seen by many in the field as a temporary solution. Those in the legal community, I should say, look at binding arbitration. It's really only something to get the two parties back together, back working. And it'll be interesting to see if whatever changes they make under binding arbitration, if that's the direction that it goes, if the changes they make will truly improve the financial situation of the DSO. Because if it doesn't, then we'll be right back where we were and have been for the last 5 months.
We've been talking with Noah Ovshinsky of WDET in Detroit. Noah, thank you very much for your time this morning.
It was a pleasure.
This is Points North Art Forms. This is Points North Art Forms. Later in the show, I'll talk with Jeff Haas. His show, Jazz Connections, is expanding to other radio stations and even changing its title. Now, Kedrick Merwin. Kedrick is music director of the Interlochen Center for the Arts. He's been watching developments with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra closely and anticipating what this could mean to Interlochen and to orchestras around the country. Given the state, the current state of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, Kedrick, and the possibility that we may be actually witnessing the death of this orchestra, or at least temporary suspension of the orchestra's, concertizing, what are you hearing about the general state of the symphony orchestra in the U.S.?
It's not in good shape, I don't think. We have some pockets of some markets that are doing really, really well. But in general, we've seen a lot of orchestras with financial difficulties. We've had several orchestras close. I think that the whole country is needing to take a look at the model that that we've been used to for symphony orchestras. And then there's some things that are going to have to change.
Now, there are many, many theories out there as to why this is happening and why some orchestras are having low ticket sales, are having heaps of debt. What is your theory?
I think that it's probably not any one thing for any one orchestra. Mm-hmm. But I think overall, my perception is that we've lost track of where our audiences are, and the orchestras have not been willing to change to keep up with where the American public is. Music listening is huge. If you take a look, iTunes has sold over 10 billion downloads. So people are listening to music, but they're not going to the orchestra. It's expensive. You have to wear fancy clothes. You go, the musicians on stage are wearing dress from the 19th century. You're being shushed if you don't clap in the right place or if you clap in the wrong place. I think we've just lost touch with the audience, and so it's less appealing for people to go.
Now, were there warning signs, Kedrick? Have we been ignoring warning signs for a while here?
I think the signs were there. I know the American Symphony Orchestra League has been aware of this and writing about it for some time. The thing that's kind of astonishing is that although people saw what was coming, and it used to be called the graying of the audience, that our audience was getting older and not being replaced, people saw that happening, but they really didn't do anything to address it, or the efforts that they did take were too small.
What kind of efforts were made? As small as they might be.
Well, certain orchestras did make some different programming choices. They tried to make some programming that would appeal to a new, younger audience. They brought in, particularly in the pop concert realm, brought in pop guest artists. Elton John would go in front of a symphony orchestra whoever it happened to be. Josh Groban would come in and perform with a symphony. So they made some efforts, but the overall experience remained the same. And maybe people would go for those concerts, but then they would be back to where they were with the a little bit old-fashioned style and dress and demeanor, and it turned some people off.
Were orchestras good at booking pop acts? You mentioned Elton John and Josh Groban, two great performers, two of my favorites. I think they're very, very talented. But were the orchestras good at the presentation side of these great talents?
My perception is that orchestras generally brought these popular talents in, but they brought them into their own realm. They didn't meet them where the popular artist was. They met them where the orchestra was. So you would have somebody who had been very successful with the public, and they would come into a situation where they were standing on the front of a stage with a microphone singing in front of an orchestra in an atmosphere that was a little bit artificial for them.
Now, did that satisfy, as you put it, the audience that was graying, or did it really not appeal to either end of the spectrum?
I think you're exactly right. I think that neither side was satisfied with this solution. And there became a big separation between the Pops concert series and your classical series. And Never the Twain Shall Meet. And both sides somewhat scoffed at each other. So I don't think that it really was an effective outreach. And I think that's proving out right now.
How long has this been going on? How long has there been a perception of a problem? How long have ticket sales lagged, et cetera?
I'm not sure of the exact numbers. I got my first orchestra job in, 89. And I know we were talking about it. We were talking about it then. It wasn't, it was something in the future. We have to watch out now because in the future our audience is graying, the demographic is getting older. But I don't think people really started to address it until maybe 15 years ago. And that's my perception. I'm not sure what the actual number is.
Can I ask you what that first orchestral gig was?
Yeah, my first job that I won was with the Augusta Symphony. I played second trombone with the Augusta Symphony for 8 years, and I was really glad to have it. It was a great learning experience, and I was pleased to play with it. They were a really good orchestra.
What did the musicians think, not only in terms of ticket sales, but in terms of their own experience? Did you and your colleagues also want to branch out? Were you becoming tired of the repertoire?
I was. I don't know that I can speak for all of my colleagues. What I found was that I was in a strange position. I had gone through school all the way through with performance degrees in trombone. I'd gotten a doctorate in trombone performance from the Eastman School. I won an orchestra job, and I was out there playing, and I could play that stuff great. But then I would get a call in Atlanta to go into the studio and record something, or get a call for a gig with a Latin band or something like that. And I had absolutely no idea what I was doing. I should have been a really well-trained trombonist. And in one sense, I was. But when it came to other areas of music, I just had no idea. And so that really had to come later after I was already a professional. I had to learn that skill set.
What was the disconnect? Was it improvisation? Was it feel?
Improvisation is a big part of it. Style is another. For a trombonist, it's different equipment as well. If you're playing a studio gig, you would have a different type of trombone than you would play in the orchestra. Exposure to a lot of different styles of music. They don't always sound the way they are printed on the page. And if you play what's printed on the page, you are immediately identified as someone who doesn't know what they're doing. So it takes some real experience just doing it and some training to figure out how to really cover a bunch of different styles.
Was there a time during which music directors were selecting 20th century pieces that were really adventuresome and getting pats on the back for it, but not exactly appealing to, as we said before, both sides of that spectrum, younger audiences or older audiences? Was there a period of time during which music directors were trying that out?
Yeah, certainly. And I think in both the experiments with aleatoric music, experiences with the complete opposite, the total control of 12-tone music, and the idea that composers would even state that who cares who listens? You know, we're writing this because it's interesting for us to write, and the musicians were performing them because they were interesting for the musicians to perform, and it really wasn't about a communication with the audience. And certainly that is something that drove audiences away. And that perception, I think, can still be out there about classical music, is that it's somehow not understandable.
Quickly, tell me, what is aleatoric music and 12-tone music?
Aleatoric music is music where your choices are made by chance. you have a wide variety of options, and perhaps the music is written by rolling dice, and then the note would be put into the score based on the dice roll. There are several different ways of randomizing information. On the other spectrum, 12-tone music is a music of total control, where each of the 12 tones of the musical scale, each half step is used before it is used again. So you use all 12 steps, all 12 half steps of the scale before another one is used. It can be very difficult to listen to.
I was going to say, even if it weren't difficult to listen to, even if the particular results of a particular piece weren't difficult to listen to, it would certainly be really different than what audiences were used to. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
One of Interlaken's reason for being is to train young musicians for positions in symphony orchestras. Now, during this time, you must be questioning the whole model. Talk about that.
I think music educators everywhere are questioning what it is that we do. And it's important to do that. And my answer to the question of why would we be training more musicians for jobs that are going away is that we're not really training classical musicians. My idea is that we're training professional musicians. And professional musicians can play in tune, in time, and in style in any situation. And there's a broad world, a vast expanse of opportunities for professional musicians. Even though the orchestral positions are drying up, there's a huge array of other opportunities to play. If you are a well-trained musician that can do those things in tune, in time, and in style, then there's a whole world of performance opportunity for you. And I think that's what we're training our students for here.
Very specifically, what are some of those opportunities?
A huge rise in opera. The Met broadcasts getting out to a general public have brought a huge rise in opera.
Really?
And so I think there are a lot of opportunities for orchestral musicians to be playing with opera. Huge opportunities for film, for video games. A lot of orchestral scores being written for video games. One of the things that we're doing here at Interlaken is we are changing our scheduling. We're changing our scheduling so that our orchestral players will be meeting at the same time as the ballet, the theater, the motion picture students, so that we can have these collaborative projects where the students learn to play in those different styles. And it'll make them much more marketable, I think, when they come out.
I can certainly understand the marketability of film and video games. I'm surprised, though, to hear you say that opera is growing in terms of job opportunities for young musicians. Why is opera not having the same problem that symphony orchestras are having?
I think the opera companies have done a better job of outreach. Also, there's the visual component, and I think that younger people who are listening to music are often looking for that visual component, whether it's through VH1 or MTV or however they're getting their video side of the popular music. Well, here's classical music with a visual side, and I think that whole artwork and that whole engagement emotionally with the characters, I think it's something that is attracting younger audiences. And then getting out into the theaters, playing the Met broadcasts where people can go and not have to feel like they have to be all dressed up and take their whole evening, I think is working.
That's a good point, because let's take Lady Gaga, for example, and some listeners may hate Lady Gaga, some may love her, some may not know who she is, but at least half of her act is reliant on the visual. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
That's exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about. And this is something that the New World Symphony down in Florida has recognized with their new concert hall. They have five very large kind of sail-like structures up behind their concert hall. And they are showing video, they're showing pictures during their performances. And this gives that visual component as well. They're also doing something which is, I think, unique to them right now, and that is that they're broadcasting from within the concert hall into speakers throughout the park, outside, and on the beach. So you can go outside of the New World Symphony's concert hall. You can be on the beach. You can look up. You can see the pictures. You can hear the sound. And it's engaging a whole other audience that maybe will stop and listen for a little bit and maybe think about going at some time.
Are there fewer and fewer purists, Kedrick, who are shouting and screaming about this kind of thing?
I still hear plenty of shouting and screaming about classical music has to really just hold itself to this standard, and that anything else that creeps in is really somehow anti-musical. And I don't believe that for a minute. I think that rather than being a museum piece of classical music, that we really need to be a vibrant, communicative organization, and that we really need to reach out and be willing to change and adapt and meet our audiences where they are, and also take the musicians to some places that they didn't know that existed.
Now, Interlaken now has a singer-songwriter program, and as of this summer, it will have a rock camp. And this certainly addresses what we're talking about. Are there any other ideas like this being discussed, being floated? If so, what are they?
We do have a number of different initiatives. A lot of them have to do with collaboration between the disciplines. What we have here is unique, I think, when you talk about dance and visual arts and motion picture arts and theater and this level of musicianship all in one place. And although there has been some collaboration in the past, that hasn't been the general operating method. And I think that that's going to become much more the standard of integrating all these arts into one performance. Specific programs that we have, we're including a recording arts program now. We are revamping our ear training theory curriculum to make use of some new electronic tools for teaching those disciplines, and looking really closely at how we can integrate our composition program into the film program, how we can begin to write for film.
Boy, that's an exciting prospect to teach students how to record, because more and more, it seems, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems that many bands, many individual artists are simply recording themselves in home studios, making their own compact discs or WAV files for iTunes. Is that correct?
Yeah. Students and bands are very interested in this. It used to be really cost prohibitive to get your band recorded and mm-hmm. out there,
right.
Or the quality that you could get on your home system just wasn't really good enough. And with the proper training, people are getting really good results on their home systems now. And it's that proper training piece that we want to address, because there are people that want to know, well, you know, how do I keep the drums from feeding back, and how do I properly record the electric guitar? So we're filling that niche, and I think that that's a real growth opportunity for us.
What are students saying when they come to camp, and has this changed over the years? What are they saying about these new opportunities? Are there actually students who might even be disappointed? Maybe they grew up thinking, you know, I can't wait to play Beethoven's Seventh and Mozart and Brahms, etc.
Those students still get to do those things. We still have the World Youth Symphony Orchestra. We still have the top band, high school band in the nation. And they're still going to be doing those. We're playing this summer Beethoven 5. We're doing Carmina Burana, Tchaikovsky 5. We've got these huge works. And so these additional programs for those students that want to be involved are available. But it's not something that we're forcing on students that want to come and play violin on Beethoven 5. They still have that opportunity.
Now, we talked about ticket sales being down for the Detroit Symphony Orchestra and even for the Philadelphia Orchestra. And even 5, 8, 10 years ago, who could have guessed that the Philadelphia Orchestra, of all orchestras, would be struggling financially? Is that happening with Interlaken ensembles too, like the World Youth Symphony Orchestra, for examples? Are ticket sales waning here too?
No, actually, we are, I guess, unique, or at least very fortunate that people continue to come. They want to hear what we're offering. Our ticket sales have been terrific, and so we're doing very well from that side. But that doesn't mean that we should stop and rely on just playing the same things. We still have to work hard to engage an audience and make sure that we stay engaging and exciting for people.
There was a time during which anticipating changes like this would make some people say, well, that indicates a lowering of standards of musical tastes. Answer them. Why is this not a lowering of standards?
It's not a lowering of standards, and it's not a lowering of standards because we still have those principal items that I mentioned before, in tune, in time, and in style. We're teaching professional musicianship, not classical musicianship. And professional musians at playing at that standard have a lot of opportunities open to them. So I don't see it in any way as a lowering of standards. And I think if you come and listen to the Interlaken Academy band, orchestra, chorus, or jazz ensemble, or come in the summer and hear the World Youth Symphony Orchestra, you're not going to notice any lowering of standards. They're outstanding groups.
Do you think it's too late for an orchestra like the Detroit Symphony Orchestra? If you were at the helm, would you say, gee, it's too late, or would you make some programming changes yourself? What would you do?
I would do everything I could to keep that orchestra alive. Mm-hmm. I think it's sad for all of us to contemplate a future without the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. So I think that that both sides need to come together and figure out a way to keep that orchestra alive and vibrant. It's a valuable resource for the country, and it's one of our major orchestras. I would hate to see it gone for good.
We've been talking with the music director of the Interlaken Center for the Arts, Kedrick Merwin. Kedrick, thank you very much for your time and your thoughts today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
This is Points North Art Forms. My next guest is composer, pianist, and bandleader Jeff Haas. Jeff is the host of Interlaken Public Radio's Jazz Connections, and the show is about to expand. IPR has begun to syndicate the show, offering it to other radio stations. The show will even undergo a name change. First of all, congratulations, and hi, Jeff.
Hey, Brad. Good to be with you.
What is the new title going to be?
It is The Stories and Sounds from the New Jazz Archive. So the title is New Jazz Archive.
The New Jazz Archive.
Correct.
And explain the title.
Well, it is a reflection of the current direction of the program. When I first put the program together, which is now about 2.5 years ago, I called it Jazz Connections because my vision for the program was trying to connect jazz to other genres of music and open the listener's mind to the fact that, hey, if their favorite artist is Jimi Hendrix or Leonard Bernstein or Willie Nelson or whatever the case may be, that there are connections between those artists and the art form of jazz. And it was an effort to ease people into the art form or make people more comfortable with jazz as a possible option for their listening pleasure.
Now, how did that change and why did that change? Because what you just explained to me sounds like a great idea.
It was my original vision for the program, and I did feel like it was a worthwhile idea. But as the program evolved, I began to realize that the program needed a little bit more narrative and perhaps some relatable stories for people to hear about to bring them into the art form a little bit more. About a year and a half ago, I had been working with a young man named Lou Bluen, a very talented bandoneon player and radio man. We were working on other projects, and I told him about my desire to develop the show and hopefully someday offer it to other radio stations. And he looked at me and said, "Are you crazy?" And I asked why, and he said, "You can't do that alone. Do you realize that shows like Diane Rehm have 5 producers and Terry Gross has a dozen?" And I was naive to that process, as my primary exposure to radio was through my father, and my father never had a producer. He did it all on his own. So I started to entertain discussion with Lou about perhaps working together with him in developing the show. So I asked him to put together sort of a mock show to give me an idea of the direction he thought, the direction that perhaps the program could take with his help.
And you liked it?
Well, at first I was sort of taken aback, Brad. Quite frankly, he did things that I was brought up not to do, so to speak. He put together a program wherein I was talking as the tune began, and I started talking before the tune was over. And my approach prior to that was always to separate the music and the commentary. And so I looked at him after he came up with that idea and showed me what it would sound like and said, "Lou, I can't do that. That's sacrilegious. You don't talk when the music's on." And that came from, growing up in the Haas household. There was no such thing as background music in my home. If we were listening to music and playing a game or talking, my father would walk through the room and turn the music off and say, "When you're ready to listen, turn it back on."
Really?
Yeah. So it was a very serious approach to music, and I had internalized it to the extent that I actually said that to Lou. I actually said, "This is sacrilegious. We can't do this." And he said, "Wait a minute. This is going to change the pace of the show. It's going to give it a little smoother feel, and it's going to engage the listener as you talk into a tune or let people know about the tune before it's actually over." And I began to sort of open my mind to that idea. The other thing that Lou brought to the table was this idea that there are lots of opportunities for people to listen to wall-to-wall music. Now, despite that, I should say, jazz may be the exception because jazz stations tend to be going extinct. So they are a dying breed. But his argument was what we need to do here is offer compelling stories and interviews about the music to draw people into the music. Jazz is looked upon as sort of an intimidating art form. Either people have misunderstandings about it, or they think jazz and they think wild saxophone solos or overpowering drummers or music that doesn't seem to have any particular structure. And obviously that's not the case. But in order to pull people in and in order to help them deal with that intimidation or that perceived intimidation, Lou suggested that everyone loves a good story. Let's dig up some great stories about this music. Let's do our research and find compelling stories that offer some connection to the music through pop culture, through television, through science, through technology, through other genres of music. And I loved the idea. I really liked the idea. And so we began to sort of explore that approach to the show. It became a lot more labor intensive. Currently, it takes us about 25 hours to put together a one-hour show.
Wow.
So we start every Monday morning with a two-hour production meeting where I pitch a topic to Lou, and he lives in Portland, Maine, so we sort of have a long-distance relationship. I pitch a topic to him with 8 or 10 talking points, and he basically plays devil's advocate and knocks each talking point down until we have 4 or 5 substantive talking points. We explore opportunities for interviews that will support those talking points. For an example, a few weeks ago we had a program about the intersection of science and jazz.
Right.
It involved 4 interviews, one with a neurosurgeon who was placing jazz musicians into an MRI environment and actually checking brain activity while they were in the MRI.
He actually did this.
He actually did this. He His name is Charles Lim. He's a neurosurgeon at Johns Hopkins. And he actually took jazz musicians and placed them in an MRI and rigged up an opportunity for them to play while in the MRI and then checked brain activity. Another interview is with a Nobel Prize winner who's the director of the National Cancer Institute in D.C., who has put together a program, a presentation with his son, who's a jazz trumpeter, called Genes in Jazz. It's a multidisciplinary presentation that he's performed at the Guggenheim, at the Smithsonian, and other venues around the country. A third interview was with a fascinating Israeli technologist who runs the tech department at Georgia Tech. And he is developing robots. He doesn't like to call them robots. He calls them robotic musicians. He's developing these robotic musicians who are able to improvise and respond in real time to other musicians. This guy sounds like a mad scientist on the air. He's just a fascinating guy. But he has actually analyzed hundreds and hundreds of solos by Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane and Sonny Rollins and fed them to the robot via algorithms. And he has an iPhone app in which he can dial up a solo and say the robotic musician's name is Shimon. So he can dial up this iPhone app and say, Shimon, I want you to play your next solo with 20% Monk, 30% Coltrane, and 50% Sonny Rollins.
Really?
Just bizarre. Fascinating interview. And the fourth interview for that show was with a best-selling science fiction writer whose themes are based in jazz. So she has these futuristic themes with nanotechnology and so forth, and people are inhabited by the spirit of Billie Holiday or Thelonious Monk. So as you can see, those kinds of diverse interviews draw the listener into the subject matter, and then we play music that exemplifies what we're talking about.
Now, how did you find all of these interview guests? Because not only are they very, very obscure, but they're perfect guests for the theme that you chose.
Mm-hmm. Well, we build the shows around the interviews. So we first locate folks who are doing interesting things or who have some connection to jazz in some way, as you said here, obscure connections. And that requires a ton of research. Lou's a great behind-the-scenes guy. Now, bear in mind that he's half my age. So not only does he have a lot more energy, but he has a distinctive younger sensibility. So we argue a lot. We have intense discussions. And I basically have to prove the merit of what it is I want to do for each show, which helps to really sort of weed out extraneous information that may not be pertinent to the theme that we're trying to develop. But the opportunity to do these interviews is just a godsend for me. I learned so much as a musician, as a composer, as an individual, and it just deepens my commitment to growing as a musician and a composer. For example, this weekend's show is a profile of Nina Simone. I've always enjoyed Nina Simone. I've always been moved by her music, but I was just bowled over by these interviews that I've done. I interviewed the only person to have written a biography in English about Nina Simone that was just released last year. Her name is Nadine Cahodas. And I also interviewed a young fellow, a writer from The New Yorker, whose name is Joe Hagan. And he, through years and years of research, found out that Nina Simone kept diaries. So he located her ex-husband. Nina Simone, of course, died in, I think, 2003. He located her ex-husband, Andrew Stroud, who is a cantankerous older fellow who had in his possession these diaries.
Wow.
And it took 6 months of cajoling on Joe Hagan's part to get him to even see the diaries to show that they actually existed. And the first thing Stroud wanted was some money to look at them. And Hagan, as any good journalist would say, indicated there was no money involved, but perhaps writing about them would would bring some attention to them, and maybe he could sell them at that point. So Hagen starts the interview by saying, "Here I had these diaries in my hand, and when I began to read them, I began to realize that this was a window on a very talented genius of an artist who was tortured with mental illness and feelings of inadequacy and so forth." And so I listened to this man talk for the better part of an hour about how seriously he took the responsibility of interpreting these very, very intimate moments in Simone's life. And I was totally captivated. I went home and listened to Nina Simone for 3 hours, which I needed to do anyway because I needed to select the set list for the program.
Sure.
But I see and hear her in a totally new light. And I'm hopeful that New Jazz Archive listeners will feel the same way. At the end of the interview, Joe Hagen says, I asked him, after we dealt with all of the Nina Simone issues, I wanted to know what it felt like to get this intimate look at this woman. And he said he went through all sorts of emotions, embarrassment, concern, guilt about reading this stuff, and more importantly, the need to take the responsibility so seriously of making sure that he presented this information in an appropriate way. It changed the way I hear Nina Simone, and I hope it will for listeners as well.
Well, the show is called The New Jazz Archive, and I'm a fan. I think it gets better week by week, and now more and more audience members, more and more radio listeners will have a chance to hear it, learn, be entertained, be informed, and be fulfilled as well.
Thank you, Brad.
That's it for another Points North Art Forms. Our thanks to Noah Ovshinsky, Kedrick Merwin, and Jeff Haas. The show was produced and engineered by Jack Connors. Our general manager is Tom Paulson, our news director, Peter Payette. Our theme was written and performed by John Wunsch. I'm Brad Aspie, and thank you for listening. You're always great, and bye for now.